5 o'clock.
Everyone, and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity.com, welcoming you every Saturday evening, and this evening is no different. We have two wonderful guests this week, and we are about to try to tackle the topic of mental illness as it pertains to murder. And so, before we introduce our guests, I'll bring in my delightful co-host, Delilah Jones. Hi, Delilah. How are you? And what would you like to say as a beginning tonight?
Well, I think this is really a timely topic and one that really needs to be explored in depth. I don't think the general public has an understanding of exactly what difficulties we see with the mental health situation, and whether it's spree murders, thrill killers, mass murderers, serial killers, it runs the gamut. And, obviously people are not in their right mind that even are able to do something like that. So, I think this is really a good topic to explore, and hopefully, our guests will give us some solutions.
Yeah, and if not solutions, more questions, and for sure things to think about and insight, because they are both very accomplished. And we've had both of these guests on before. I think we can say Dwayne Bowers is kind of a semi-regular. This might be his fifth or so appearance on our show, right, Delilah? Something like that, fourth or fifth. And so we like him, or else he wouldn't get invited back. he is from the Washington, D.C. area. He's a professional counselor, a consultant, an expert in trauma and stress. He is also a hypnotherapist. He has a wealth of knowledge in many, many areas, works with the Center for Exploited Children. And Jennifer Bishop Jenkins, I met her several months ago, and my life was enriched. She brings a wealth of knowledge to the table. She is a homicide survivor. She is an advocate of many causes. And she is also a mother of a person in her family who lives with mental illness, and very much a political policy person, and has many causes that she would like to talk about. And we have talked about those in the past, but I think tonight we focused mainly on mental health issues as it relates to homicide. So without further ado, Jennifer and Dwayne, thank you so much for being with us. It's a delight to have you again.
Thank you so much, Donna.
Thank you, Donna. Good to be here.
Yes, and you're both very welcome. And with that, I thought that maybe to kind of start out, I would read a formal definition, because I think maybe sometimes the waters get a little muddied when we talk about mental illness, that people aren't really familiar with what it is and what it isn't. And this is from a reputable source. It's from the Mayo Clinic. And perhaps you can give your take on it, and we'll start from there. Mental illness refers to a wide range of mental health conditions, disorders that affect your mood, thinking, and behavior. Examples of mental illness include depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, eating disorders, and addictive behaviors. Many people have mental health concerns from time to time, but a mental health concern becomes a mental illness when ongoing signs and symptoms cause frequent stress and affect your ability to function. A mental illness can make you miserable and can cause problems in your daily life, such as at work or in relationships. In many cases, mental illness symptoms can be managed with a combination of medications and counseling or psychotherapy. So that is the formal definition from the Mayo Clinic. Dwayne, being a professional counselor, why don't you give us your take on, do you agree with that definition, or would you like to tweak it, or what would you like to say about that?
I think I'll have to agree with it because it was so broad and so general.
Okay.
And it pretty much covered everything. I think when we look from a diagnosis point of view, the things that we look for are does the mental malady interfere with well-being, interfere with the ability to function at work, at home, and in relationships? And those are some of the things that we look at specifically, and all those were covered. So I'll say, yes, I agree with the definition.
Okay, as a broad, generic definition. Jennifer, what would be your comments to that?
Well, I definitely love that we have this to respond to, and I agree that it's a wonderful, a good, broad, general definition. The only thing I would add to it, would come from my recent close association with the National Alliance of Mentally Ill, NAMI, website,
right.
NAMI.org. Highly recommend everybody who is interested in the topic go into and learn the many wonderful free resources that NAMI gives to the public. And NAMI gave, our family, when we discovered our daughter's mental illness, free 12-week training courses, tons of material. We took courses with other families. We learned about this. It was like going back to college and just learning about a mental illness. And one of the phrases that they use often is biological brain disorder, that mental illness is a biological brain disorder, because quite often people who are mentally ill, actually there is a physiological cause in the brain. In my daughter's case, it's a neurotransmitter disorder, a chaos in four or five of the neurotransmitters in her brain that developed after puberty, and we saw the very dramatic deterioration accelerating out of her years of puberty. And a biological brain disorder helps, I think, folks to understand that there are biological root causes, and you should consider in some ways, because there's so much stigma associated with mental illness, and
right.
Of course today we're going to be talking about criminal justice, and it's very, very appropriate for us to be extremely concerned when those two topics intersect.
Right.
But, we all need to understand as a society that this is just like getting diabetes. You can't be angry at a person who has a biological brain disorder. You want to say any more than you would say to a diabetic, snap out of it, fix your blood sugar right now, stop this. You want to make them, behave themselves. And, people with mental illness are no more in control of their bodily functions in this regard than would be a diabetic or someone with cerebral palsy or some other major illness.
Yeah, very, very well said, and I agree. I'm pretty amazed. They're able to, either one of you, they're able to pinpoint the exact location of the dysfunction or disorder that's specifically in the brain?
Well, they did not. Mm-hmm. They did a very exhaustive diagnostic process, and it took us years, by the way, to get enough of a medical history built up and then take her to the Mayo Clinic and finally, and have them spend, weeks going through piles of records of nine different doctors and several years of hospitalizations and various issues. And they had to do a full life history on her. It was quite an exhaustive process. But, yes,
wow.
The diagnosis was clear.
Mm. Is that, Dwayne, is that a typical type of assessment that's done once people come to a professional and say we've exhausted all of our normal resources? Is that the kind of protocol one would expect? If they didn't go to the Mayo Clinic?
I would say for perhaps the large majority of folks who come to counseling and whatever for mental health reasons, no, they don't go through that exhaustive of a background check or that exhaustive of a diagnosis. One other thing I'd just like to say is not every mental health diagnosis has been proven to this point to have a biological reason yet.
Right.
Particularly your personality disorders. And so we want to be careful to not encourage the audience to think that every mental illness can be diagnosed at this point in time to a biological reason. Perhaps in the future, yes, because it certainly looks like we're moving in that direction. But at this point in time, not every mental health diagnosis has been associated with a biological reason.
A biological, yeah, that's interesting because we have a colleague that specializes in knowing and teaching about the personality disorders. Another fact that I read, and I think it's common knowledge, is that, and this is from NAMI, is that 1 in 4 American adults live with some form of mental illness. Is that true, according to your knowledge?
If you're talking with me, yes. I would say that would be true. 25% is probably a very accurate projection, because we're talking about things from anxiety to depression to ADHD with kids. And when you start looking at some of those broader diagnoses, yeah, that covers a lot of people. So, yeah, I would say 1 out of 4. Now, that doesn't mean they're necessarily in counseling or necessarily on medication, but they are probably in some way struggling with a mental health disorder. Yeah.
Yeah, that seems, well, I don't know. I guess in view of what we're seeing today, I'm really not surprised. I'm not surprised by that number. But I was just wondering, how do we differentiate sociopathy from mental illness? Does one lead to another, or can they coexist? And maybe either one of you can explain what the difference is between a sociopathic person and someone with a mental illness, just so that we understand that they don't all run together in our mind.
I'll
go ahead,
take a stab at that, although I'm not the professional here, Dwayne is, but I can tell you that the dangerous sociopath was a label given to the young man that killed my sister, her husband, and their baby 23 years ago, and he was in a mental hospital in Chicago at the age of 16 after having tried to kill his own parents, and they finally there was many other incidences in his life, and they finally put him in the hospital, and he was diagnosed as a dangerous sociopath, although sociopath, and Dwayne, I'm sure, can explain, is not so much a medical diagnosis anymore as it is a sort of a general category of conversation about behaviors. It's simply the way it played out in our family is that when he was a very emotionally flat person. That is, his affect was very flattened, and he didn't feel great ups or downs. He was kind of a cold character, very smart, but came from a well-to-do family and had good grades in school and was a very bright young man. But had this, the older he got, the more he had to seek out dangerous and hurtful behaviors in order to get a rush, to feel something, because he was sort of just all the time this very cold, calculating character. And he would literally, and this is where the sociopath part comes in, he could look at another human being, and in the case of my beautiful 25-year-old pregnant sister and her wonderful husband, Richard, you know, he was able to look at them and not see anything other than a mere object for his entertainment. He shot them both, literally, as he said, because he just wanted to see what it would feel like and because of for the thrill of it. And that is a sociopathic thing to do. He didn't feel
that. And a lack of conscience then, right, Jennifer? A total lack of
conscience
is what you're talking about?
And felt nothing other than a desire to be entertained by this and still, you know, justifies and it sort of constructs a manipulative reality around his own, you know, self-justified view of things. It's quite scary. And when you read in some of the, you know, like the DSM-4, you know, I realize now there's a new DSM out, but they talk about this as a sort of an incurable thing. There really isn't a way you can grow a conscience in a person.
Right. Now how would we also say that this person had to have had a mental illness to be able to commit these crimes? This is the big problem for me to understand this on an emotional as well as an intellectual level. Does one go hand in hand? If you're a sociopath and you have no conscience and you're doing these spree killings or you know, thrill killings, whatever, do you also have to have a mental illness diagnosis, Duane?
I think what you'll find with sociopathology and understand that just in general terms, social pathology means that someone has pathological behavior that does not meet the social norms. And so there's a wide range of what could be considered social pathology. But what you're going to find is with folks who commit the most egregious crimes that there is a mental health diagnosis. Very often it's antisocial or asocial behavior, and those are all diagnosable mental health disorders, many of which now do have a biological root, or at least research is beginning to show a biological root for a lot of the antisocial and asocial behaviors. So, you know, social pathology can range from a wide range of behaviors, but when it does start to be violent, you will find that they have diagnosis. They have a mental health diagnosis, that there is a mental illness involved.
And for someone like me who's been very interested in criminal justice and mental illness for quite some time for obvious reasons, I really am intrigued by the increasing availability of really good diagnostic assessment tools that have been created to actually be able to provide some quantification and some scientific description and measurement to people where you can actually use these diagnostic tools. There's a depravity scale that's been invented. There's a Dr. Robert Hare, H-A-R-E, is the definitive person who started developing psychopathological assessment tools to discover who were psychopaths, and he has posited the theory that there's approximately about 3% of the population of the world that is psychopathic, and there are these measurement tools, you know, now that you can get to do that. But I think the real question that lies before us is, what do you do with that population of people? And I think when you, Donna, I don't mean to be reading into your question, but I'm assuming that the reason you're as troubled about the question that you ask as I am is because then you raise the question, if they are mentally ill, should they be punished for what they've done? If what they've done is really, really horrible. And I think so the question merges then into this larger question of culpability, consequences, accountability, responsibility, and certainly prevention. All of those, you know, those are the vital conversations. And in terms of the solutions that we have to get to, we have to be talking about how you identify and how you prevent. Certainly easy access to guns is just the most biggest no-brainer on the planet when it comes to, you know, psychopaths and sociopaths. But what do you do about holding them culpable? I mean, the man who killed my sister and her husband and their baby is serving a life sentence that I strongly support. He needs to be behind bars. He is, to this day, dangerous, and the crime that he committed, he wasn't compelled to do it. He knew what he was doing was illegal and dangerous. And so I think, you know, there are questions that the law asks about culpability that really do push these boundaries of how, and you know, how we're going to define and understand mental illness. And I strongly support not, of course, criminalizing mental illness. In fact, the most important thing to note here is that the mentally ill are quite often way more likely to be a victim of crime than they are to be a perpetrator of crime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very important stereotype to clear up.
Well, isn't that true? And maybe it depends upon the state, but in many trials, and if there is a mental health component, then they would find them not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect versus guilty, and you go and you get treatment, and then you go to jail. That's what I mean, I don't know how pervasive that is. Is that across the
every state does it differently, and every state needs to
right.
get consistent on this. I find it stunning in our country that there are many states that don't even have a guilty but insane plea,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, outcome criminally is not a good outcome for victims' families or for the public to acknowledge
no.
that, hey, this guy did it, but he was insane, and then steer him into, you know, incarceration in a hospital as opposed to a prison is entirely appropriate in certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this leads me to a question for either or both of you. For the listener's benefit and for my benefit, is there a difference, and what is the difference between a mental illness and insanity, and is it treated the same, or are there the same options? Just kind of describe the difference between those two words, and maybe they mean the same thing.
The insanity is not a diagnosis. Insanity, you won't find insanity in the DSM. Insanity is a sort of a lay description of someone who is not functioning well. A mental illness, at least from a mental health point of view, is one that can be diagnosed, one that has certain criteria that have to be met in order to have that diagnosis. Insanity is not one of those diagnoses. It's a generalized term.
But Duane, is that the term that the law uses?
It is, but I said from a mental health point of view,
yeah.
It's not a diagnosis.
They should replace it with some other term, Duane, then, because it's so generic or something. Is there a better legal term they could use that encompasses what it actually is?
I think not guilty due to mental illness is a far better term, because what that means is we've been able to diagnose that there is an illness here. When you say by insanity, that's just a subjective judgment term based on something that a lawyer decided or a judge decided.
I mean, I think we need to have the following. I agree we should stop using the word insane in the law and talk about mental illness. I think that we need to have guilty but mentally ill options. I don't think that, guilt or innocence is a different legal question. Did they do it or didn't they do it? That's one decision that the law has to factually make. But then the other decision is, and that's why in every murder trial, and we're talking about murder today, there is two separate proceedings. There is a trial. Guilty or innocent, did they do it or not? And then there is a separate, different date, different proceeding, weeks later usually, sentencing procedure in which the judge or jury awards the sentence, the consequence for the crime. And those are two different decisions. So one decision, guilty or innocent, did they do it or not, that's one statement, and then the other is consequences or culpability, and that is where the mental illness would come to play, is the question of culpability. How consequentially can you, hold them accountable? Should they go to a hospital? Should they go to a prison? For how long? What would then be the conditions of some future release for them, et cetera?
Right. Well, my take on that is they are guilty of committing the crime, but due to the mental illness, so get treatment first, and then after you get treatment where you are sufficiently stable and monitored, then you start to serve your sentence. But that's only my opinion.
You know, that's kind of hard because if somebody is really, really seriously, you know, hearing voices and not really in any way responsible, measurably responsible for their behavior, it's hard to see punishing them for the rest of their lives once they get healthy. That seems difficult to me. On the other hand, I think you have to take these things case by case. There's just no question about
true.
It. And you have to look at demonstrated culpability on the part of the individual. If you looked at the life of my sister's killer, no question about it, he was a sociopath and didn't have a conscience and probably through the best scientists today could even be treated in some ways. But he also met every standard for culpability. He snuck around. He knew it was illegal. He was hiding it. He planned it alone and in advance for months in advance. He knew what he was doing. He acted alone. He didn't act impulsively. He planned it carefully. He hid it. He threatened to do it again. All of those things were criteria that led him to be fully held legally accountable under the law and went to jail for life.
So, that initial pattern of conduct really makes a big difference in terms of evaluating what the sentencing should be. Yeah.
And I think I think this raises the real issue. We sort of jumped to determining guilt and innocence and then what. But I think the real issue here is, and as we look at some of the particularly mass violence cases, there has, and even in the case that Jennifer's referring to, there was a long mental history here, a mental health history here. And the question has to be not so much are they guilty, how should they be treated, but if this person showed this kind of behavior and was capable of doing this, and there was a long history of this person, how did they ever get to a point that they could actually do this? Where did the system fail them that didn't say, hey, we've got a problem, pull this person out of the social context, help them now so that they can function in a social context, you know, making them well so that they can spend their life in prison. Well, if you have the ability to make them well, why didn't that happen way back when all of these other signs were indicated? And I think this is where...
Well said, Dwayne. Well said.
Yeah, very true.
I think this is where a lot of folks are actually, you know, there are two culprits being thrown around in the media. One is guns and one is mental health. But no one's willing to say, you know what, in many of these major mass violence cases, there was a warning. You know, at Virginia Tech, a psychologist went to the administration and said, we have a problem, we need to do something, and the administration chose not to. With the Navy Yard shooting, there was a warning made to the bosses that, hey, there's a problem here, and they were not listened to. And I think I'm not putting a blame out there. I'm saying where we
well,
fall
maybe
short
you should.
Is when somebody does diagnose, nobody knows what to do with it. You know, Virginia Tech said.
Well, one of the problems in our country, and this is the historian here, I was very interested in myself because I can't even find good housing programs for my daughter now. We as a country decided to deinstitutionalize mentally ill people many decades ago, and we dismantled systematically all of the places where they could be taken because there were a lot, frankly, quite realistically, there was a lot of horror stories about the mass institutionalization of the mentally ill and what was happening behind those walls. And so there was a collective national decision decades ago that we would deinstitutionalize the mentally ill and that we would treat them in the community and that they would be handled in the community. And that was actually delivered with the promise that there would be resources delivered to the community in order to handle those cases of people. But in fact, of course, those resources have never been delivered. There are no community. There are very few, I should say, very few community-based resources, all woefully underfunded. And that's
right.
when, of course, the massive homelessness in our country began, was
right.
when we deinstitutionalized the mentally ill.
Mm-hmm. That is a huge problem.
There is another side to that.
Go ahead.
And that is that. When we had the institutions, when we had the state hospitals and whatever, everyone was treated exactly the same, regardless of diagnosis. And what they were suggesting was, if we can create these community programs, halfway houses, residential programs for specific diagnoses, they get more specifically what they need, and it allows the individual to function to the degree they are able. One of the things about the institutions was, it didn't matter how well you functioned. If you were there, you were treated pretty much the same and medicated pretty much the same. And this recognized that people can function at different levels and need different types of support. And that was the whole idea behind the community programs and the residential programs. And
But they're just not well resourced enough, right?
And what unfortunately happened was, as we deinstitutionalized, we created, at least here in D.C., a whole population of homeless that had no place to go, and they did not have the community resources available. And so they said, okay, come back and get your meds once a week. And they stopped, of course, coming and getting their meds. And so then we now have a very large homeless population that have mental health issues here in this city.
I think that happened in a lot of cities. It's not just there, it's everybody. And I should just mention briefly that with an attempt with the state of Connecticut dealing with Newtown Sandy Hook, President Obama, through the U.S. Department of Education, has just awarded a $1.9 million grant for more support services for mental health, specifically for Newtown, which is a very good thing. And we're hoping, our state is looking for answers and trying to be the model for other states with respect to schools, and looking to see, you know, would that translate into maybe one more psychologist, one more mental health person per school or what. But, you know, it's really very much on the forefront, but the people with regard to the gun lobbies and the gun owners, it's a battle between those two forces.
May I say something about that, Donna? Because
go ahead.
The gun issue is something that is so, I mean, obviously the young man that killed my sister, her husband, and their baby was able to get a gun, and his parents knew, A, that he was a dangerous sociopath, B, that he had tried to kill them, and C, that he was trying to obtain a gun. They knew all those things, and yet they left him unsupervised almost all the time. So this is a serious problem in our country. The Sandy Hook shooter was a young man who had a serious mental health issue. His mother knew that he had one, and she allowed unlocked guns to be available to him in their home. She liked guns. She actually encouraged him to use them. That was a mistake on her part, and obviously it cost her own life as well as all of
them. They went shooting together.
For families. Now, if you look at other countries, the key difference between the United States of America and every other country in the world on this issue, the reason why there aren't the mass murders, I mean, we have 30,000 gun deaths a year in our country, when the average country in the world might have 2 or 12 or 20. We have 30,000. No other country even comes close to us. And we have over 13,000 that were killed by just these mass, you know, these individual and mass homicides. And the difference in the United States is the easy access of guns by mentally ill and dangerous people, people who have criminal records and people who have mental health issues. Other countries have guns. Now, there's as many guns in Canada per person as there is almost in the United States. But the difference there is because they keep extremely well-regulated who can access them. You can't access them if you have mental health or criminal behavior issues. And in the United States, we are completely unregulated the access to guns.
Definitely. I remember seeing posters way back in the early 80s, to what you had said, U.S., and it had, you know, thousands of
of killings, and then the second one on the higher up was Japan, and they had two in 1 year versus, you know, I don't know how many thousands. So it has carried on from that time to this day, and it is not getting better. And, you know, I think the lobbyists and the gun owners are just, you know, their amendment rights and all, but we certainly are not going to, I think there's always going to be that battle, and we're not going to solve it particularly, but
most gun owners agree, though, that there should be background checks on everybody who runs them, and if you have a mental health background problem, then you should not get a gun if you have any history of violent tendencies. And I think there's gun owners agree on that, so that the polling data is pretty clear. Most Americans agree about that. I think it's something we can all do. We just need some courageous members of Congress to make it happen.
Well, yeah, and I agree. We've even tightened up on the magazines here, our state laws, that they have to fill out a bunch of paperwork and make sure that is known in terms of the kinds of magazines they have, and also it's really taken its toll here. We're trying to do certain things, but I don't know how it's going to all end up in the wash. But I totally agree with you, Jennifer. I really do. With respect to mental health, and I know we're jumping around a little bit because unfortunately we have about 23 minutes and this is not enough time for this topic, obviously. But Jennifer, can you give us a thumbnail sketch, if you would, in terms of what is it like to live with a person in your own household who has mental illness? Can you kind of do a bird's eye view of that?
No, that's a great question, and I'll try to summarize, you know, years of complex issues in a fairly short period. But I can tell you that, you know, a lot of the stages of grief are stages parents go through. First, there's sort of a denial, then you're angry, then you're sort of depressed about it, then you finally, you know, hopefully can move to, you know, you try to cut deals, and then you try to move to acceptance or whatever. I mean, I feel like I went through all of those phases with my own daughter, even though I know mental health. I taught high school psychology for many years as a social studies teacher. I know this stuff, and yet I, in my own mind, just could not separate at first the difference between, oh, she's just an angsty teenager who's just behaving badly, to, oh, she's really, you know, this is really serious. This is a mental illness that she can't control. And then, of course, we had to learn to separate what were the problems caused by the drugs and alcohol she was self-medicating with, to what was actually the illness. And it took years, and it took patience, and it took wonderful, and speaking of intersecting with a criminal justice system, it took wonderful police. Our local Northfield, Illinois Police Department could not have been more amazing, very well-trained crisis responders. Wow. When we would have issues with her, they knew about her mental health condition probably even better than I at first. They knew how to talk down and handle the situation, and they knew the difference between taking her to the hospital in an ambulance and taking her to the jail. And because we were lucky to live in a community with good police who had, when she would get violent or would get, you know, do destructive things, they always handled it with an ambulance to the hospital, where she would then be sort of mandated to be under an assessment for several days, and that would buy us a couple of days of time to get her, you know, back on her meds if that was the problem, or to try a new medication if that was what we needed to do. And there were many times that she was forced against her will, but then she would usually acquiesce after a couple of days to stay in a hospital until she was safe to be released again. And we went through, you know, a lot of this. This is years and years. But we also saw violence. We saw suicide attempts. We saw her attacking. We saw, you know, a lot of dangers. It was difficult. And it was only because we were working incredibly hard and we were very diligent. And I just compare our reaction to the reaction of the parents of the young man who killed my family members. They were busy and active people, but they had their own businesses. And when they saw his warning signs, they just didn't react. They let him go. They let him do what he wanted to unsupervised. They let him have a padlock on his bedroom door, behind which he had a gun and all of these other things. I think good parenting, hands-on, taking them to the doctor, being willing to fight with them and being willing to push to get treatment and push to get diagnoses. And I had to change doctors and go different mm-hmm. places and keep pushing until we got the right diagnosis and got the right medication. So it takes patience. It takes persistence. But it also takes a hands-on commitment that you are not going to let them endanger them. So we had to go out and buy a safe and lock up every knife in the house, every piece mm-hmm. of aspirin or anything like that. We had to change the way we lived around our own house. We had to be very diligent about it. So it's...
Well,
it's,
you know, I've said over and over on in a lot of different shows, we as a society, we tend to, and even in the criminal justice system, in the mental health industry, we're very reactive instead of being proactive, like... Obviously, you've done, Jennifer, for many years. You've been very proactive with your own situation so that this does not turn into a situation that you have to react to or society even has to react to.
Right. Right. And you know, would that the my sister's killer's parents had been as diligent.
Right. Well, Wayne, the one common denominator that I see in a lot of these high-profile cases is isolation, and that affords them the opportunity to do things behind closed doors without people intruding to know what their plan is and all. Is that a necessary ingredient to this type of person where they always are kind of ostracized and they seek to always be by themselves, and then it kind of just escalates from there?
I think it's very common to see the withdrawal behavior, particularly in antisocial behavior. And I also want to kind of make the differentiation between, you know, we're talking about homicide and we're talking about murder. The average mass killer is a much different person than someone who attends to seek a target and go after that target for whatever reason. I want your coat, I want your body, whatever. The person that's in mass murder or mass violence, the killing of people is not about the killing of people. It's about getting attention. It's about making a point. And so they don't target people. They just shoot whoever is convenient. They kill whoever is convenient to reach their goal of getting attention or getting heard or whatever it is they think that they are accomplishing here. So they very often don't even see the person that they are shooting. A perfect example is the guy that was involved in the shooting with Gabby.
Gabrielle Giffords. I just put up a review of her audiobook. That's what I was thinking as you were talking.
One of the points was that one of the victims in that case was a six-year-old girl, and he did not know he shot a six-year-old girl. He pointed the gun at her and fired and did not know he killed a six-year-old girl until he was told in jail. So there's a difference in the mental health issues, and there's a difference in the goal between someone who is seeking out and targeting someone for murder as opposed to someone who is doing a mass murder kind of situation. So we want to consider that as we're looking at the mental health issues.
Keep that in mind. Yeah.
In
that particular case, was he actually targeting Gabby Giffords? You know,
he knew she was there. He went there because she was there. And so she was an intended target, but there was a bigger issue here, and that was she was a target to accomplish a bigger end. And very often with the mass, it's not so much that. Very often I just helped the Office of Victims of Crime put together some research on a training on this. Very often in mass murder, there is a goal. There is a point I'm trying to make. There's I'm trying to be heard. And so it doesn't really matter how many people die. The more that die, the more you will listen to me, the more you will hear me. It's not so much about moment of fame as it is you need to recognize me, you need to hear me. And so it becomes an issue of numbers, not who I'm shooting, but how many I'm shooting. And and very often these folks are well aware of the fact, or actually want, that the end of this will be in their own death and that they become martyred. And very often when they're caught instead of killed, you see the whole thing fall apart. They just turn into jelly because they didn't have an alternate plan of not dying. They anticipated dying as a result. All I'm trying to say here is we really need to be careful in lumping everyone who murders together in a mental health perspective or even in a legal perspective, because the goals, the thinking, the mental health issues are generally much different. So yes, in those kinds of cases, the isolation is a big part of it, because they're planning, they're putting together the what their goal is, what they're going to be martyred for, et cetera. And you see on their computers, they do a lot of research into vigilantism and into different organizations of ill repute that tend to be militaristic, let's say.
Right.
I agree with the idea about limiting weapons. Certainly, at my field, where I really focus is, let's get these assault weapons off the street. My God, nobody has a need for an assault weapon. You don't shoot deer with an assault weapon. You know what? Who justifies assault weapons? And yet, they are one of the ones that no one wants to legislate, and I just don't get that. But I'm sorry, I'm babbling.
And absolutely, that was true in Virginia Tech and in the Tucson massacre. They were only able to stop them when they stopped to reload.
Yes,
and they
absolutely.
They had so many magazines, so many bullets.
Same with the guy, maybe this is what you just said, the guy in the theater in Arizona.
Aurora, Colorado.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes. How they got him, was his gun jammed.
Well, here's another example, and again, started out in my state in Stanford. Miriam Carey, it happened right around the same time as the D.C. shooter, the IT person there. Here she was, a dental hygienist with a little baby, had depression with psychosis, I guess was the diagnosis, and thought that President Obama was after her. So she drives her car to the White House and is trying to see him get there, and she is shot to death. Someone with depression but with psychosis, what exactly does that mean, and how did it escalate to that severity where they felt that they had to shoot to kill?
There were two things going on here. Psychosis, number one, means that I have a difficulty. No, let's put it this way. I create my own reality. I'm hearing voices. I'm seeing hallucinations. And so my reality is much different than yours, and we're in the same room. So I respond to that reality in a much different way. Usually there's paranoia that goes along with that, with the psychotic behavior. But the other thing, and this is what people are missing, police are trained to, when someone is using a vehicle as a weapon, to stop that weapon. And she was using the vehicle as a weapon. She was trying to hit people and kill people. She was trying to, I'm not saying out of sound reasoning, but certainly this is what was happening. They had to stop that weapon. And people didn't seem to get that. They said, oh, they didn't have to shoot her. Well, yeah, they did, because she was hurting people. I don't think they had a choice between shooting her and killing her, because she was in a car and she was going 35 miles an hour when she was shot. Unfortunate her baby was in the car, absolutely. But unfortunate that this woman has a diagnosis of psychosis and she has access to her baby and her car. I'm going back to where I came from before. The diagnosis had been made. People knew there were problems, and yet there's a lack of understanding of what that means and how do we keep this from escalating, just like your case, Jennifer.
Yeah, I know. It's,
clearly.
It's, and it's, really, It's really disturbing to me because another force that complicates this is that we have HIPAA requirements now. We have such emphasis on medical privacy.
Oh, right. Confidentiality.
It's very, very hard to get the openness to be able to intervene. If you see somebody that you know is dangerous and you suspect that could really be something that you should step in to try to prevent a serious situation. We had many people say to us after this man killed our family members that they would say, oh, yeah, we knew about that guy. Yeah, he definitely, we I was like, well, then why the hell didn't you say something? Because, in this day and age, but then you also have the civil libertarians and the emphasis on personal freedoms. Can you force somebody into treatment if you know that they're dangerous? So we would have to, as a society, embrace these diagnostic tools and get serious about the science to say that if somebody has certain criteria, we are going to put certain restrictions on them as a preventative. And that's a social willingness that I just don't think we're at yet, but I think we need to get there.
I would agree with that and add one other thing. Mental health professionals, by law in every state, must report someone who they deem as being harmful to themselves or someone else, or will lose their license if they don't. And in many of these cases, we heard that mental health professional did report and say this person is violent, this person is at risk, we need to do something. But whoever they reported to was afraid of legal, of being sued, of liability, if they did take an action just based on a mental health person's diagnosis. And so, and in our litigious society, I'm not saying that's necessarily wrong of them to think of that, but look at the outcome. I mean, look at the cost of not taking the chance of being sued. So you're absolutely right. There needs to be a change in how society looks at taking the risk to help someone as opposed to looking at necessarily are we violating their rights by doing this. There's got to be a place in between that would work for everyone.
Yes, there just has to be, and there. I think as we go along with more and more mass shootings, the awareness has to be heightened, and more people are affected. Therefore, you would think, by law of averages, that people would start to think, hey, this has to be a priority, and forget about the fact that I want to carry my gun. The mental health issue has to take priority, but. I am curious as to your opinions with regard to with the beginnings of a heightened awareness of people with mental health problems in the media. Is there a true escalation of crime associated with mental health issues, or is this a false perception? Has it always been there, or are the people with mental health issues, quote-unquote, coming out of the closet?
I mean, I have to tell you that, that this actually has a lot, the increase in mass murders by clear psychopaths that is definitely on the increase. It is absolutely clearly on the rise, although in general, violent crime is going down in our country, and that has to do mostly with two factors, the aging of the population as the baby boomers are getting older, and second, believe it or not, the interjection of cell phones into our society has actually gone a long way to reduce crime. So those two factors have brought, in general, the crime rate down, but the number of mass murders, especially by psychopaths armed with assault weapons, has gone up dramatically, and that has happened only in connection to the changes in the law and the availability after 2004 of assault weapons to the general public with these high-capacity ammunition capabilities. Once those became widely available to the general population, you can literally see it on a graph, what happens to these mass horrific shootings.
Wow.
They've also been able to tie availability of internet and Of course, video games and that sort of thing, to particularly the perpetrators of mass violence, because they are drawn to, again, like I said, the websites of the military organizations, and to, in fact, a couple of the mass murder situations we've seen were literally fashioned after video games, literally step-by-step what happens in certain of these violent video games. So they've also been able to, for that population, I'm not saying, you know, the guy who walks down the street and says, hey, I want your jacket and shoot you. I'm saying the mass murderer, the one who has the asocial personality disorder, is drawn to watch through internet and through video games and plan through these things and identify through these things, and it gives them the courage and the plan to go forward. And have you looked at, you know, how can you build a bomb on the internet? Have you looked at how can I buy an assault weapon on the internet? It's
right.
All very available.
The Unabomber. We had David Kaczynski, Ted's brother, on the show a year and a half ago. It was very, very, I happen to know him personally, a very fascinating gentleman, and I don't know, it's just, it's incredible to hear that story as well. So, yes, those are all other elements that we have to contend with. Dwayne and Jennifer, Jennifer, I know you've been asked to be on a NAMI task force of some type or a committee.
I'm very, very proud to be asked to be joining the local Cook County North Suburban National Alliance of the Mentally Ill Board of Directors, so I'm very excited about that. And I'm also serving on a committee that focuses in Illinois on the intersection between criminal justice and mental illness, hence my interest in this topic, because this committee actually is very focused on trying to not criminalize the mentally ill, and they're trying to, you know, point out the fact that so many people in prisons really, you know, shouldn't have been routed to a prison. They should have been routed to treatment, that these quite often are people who are just trying to self-medicate, or they are unable to be, they're chaotic thinkers, or you know, they have anger management issues or whatever. And it's criminalizing the mentally ill is a huge problem in our country, and we have to find the right balance by looking case by case between not criminalizing the mentally ill, but also sorting out those people who are truly dangerous and who do need to be incarcerated, probably for a long, long time, if not for life. In those cases, we have to be very willing to make those decisions. It is tough.
It is. And in our last, we have about 2 minutes left or so, do you have thoughts on how do we get rid of the stigma associated with mental illness, whether, you know, in any way, shape, or form? Is it going to reach that level where some other things, as in, you know, have lost their stigma? Does it take 50 years?
I think we've come a long way already. Certainly we have in my lifetime. And what has helped it is big-named people of notoriety who have come out and written books about their struggle with depression, or their loved ones struggle with psychosis or whatever, and are normalizing it more and more and saying, hey, look, this happens to everyone. And then we have political personnel, Michelle Obama, who focuses on mental health, and different folks who give it a different face, who give it a real face. You know, the only face of mental illness we see in this country usually is on the news. And so when you hear, you've got a talk show with some big-name star talking about their struggle with depression or whatever, it gives it a different face. And I think that's how we do it. We help people to realize that anybody's face could be behind this diagnosis. And we've moved
we
a long way.
We have to humanize it, right?
When I was a high school kid, my mother suffered from depression, and we were in Ohio, and it was not acceptable to go to mental health. It was considered weakness. It was considered, first of all, mental health wasn't even, practitioners weren't considered as being credible. So, you know, we've come a long way in maybe too far in medication, but we've come a long way go ahead.
I'm just saying that unfortunately our show is counting down. We'll have to do a second hour on this if the two of you would consider it. It's just gone by very, very quickly, so I'm going to have to say thank you both, Jennifer and Dwayne, and everyone. Have a good evening, and we will see you next Saturday on another episode of Shattered Life. Thank you, Delilah, and we'll talk to you off air. Good evening.